Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be talking about that hole in your memory before the earliest one you can produce, also known as infantile amnesia. And hey, listeners, you were promised you would be getting some baby looked at me topics this year. My wife and I had a baby this past October, and I think many of you have been practically daring me to embark on indulgent dad topics. But here we've arrived at one, because I think the way I got here was recently we have started spending a lot of time trying to make a 5-month-old baby laugh. Rob, I don't know how much experience you have with this, like the parent comedian routine.
Oh, yeah. A lot of hours clocked on that particular stand-up gig.
Well, sometime recently, Rachel figured out what our baby's favorite genre of comedy was, at least for that day. And it was a textile gravity comedy. It was the act was you hold a cloth up in the air and then you drop the cloth on the baby. And when the cloth falls down and hits the baby, this is hilarious. It was creating these storms of laughter from another dimension. Truly riveting experience, at least for us. But I started to wonder, like, why is this funny? And of course, I wanted to ask her, but she's a 5-month-old baby, not talking yet. She can't explain why it's funny. And, I was thinking, one day, will I be able to ask her, you remember when we were dropping the cloth on you and you thought this was so funny? Why was it funny? What was going through your mind? But I just know that's probably never a conversation that's going to go anywhere, because is she really going to even remember this by the time she can talk about it? Because I certainly don't have any memories that I can bring up now from being 5 months old, or even from being 1 year old, or even from being 2 years old. I'm not sure, honestly, what my earliest memory is, but I know I don't have any memories I feel confident about from the first several years of my life. And it turns out this is not unique to me. This is pretty common. Most people feel this way, that they don't have any really solid memories from the first several years of their lives. And so I just got really interested in the question of why that is.
Yeah. I mean, unless your biological mother partook of the waters of life while she was pregnant, you're probably not pre-born like that. You're not going to remember these things. And we'll get into some. There is a certain amount of subjectiveness to all of this, and we'll get into some of that. And certainly we'd love to hear from any listeners out there who are firm on this, or feel firm on this and are like, yes, I do remember being under the age of two, that sort of thing. But most of the research seems to point in a different direction, that it seems like most of what we remember is after a certain point in our development, and that certainly your daughter has not quite reached that point.
Which is not to say that she is not capable of memory, because, I mean, several things I can notice. She recognizes faces, and she is forming associations and routines. There's learning going on at this point in a baby's development, and learning is to some extent based on memory. So it's not that the brain is not capable of any type of memory at this point, but it seems that most people's brains at this point are not producing episodic or autobiographical memories. Episodic memories meaning memories of specific events or experiences. Not producing sort of narrative memories of that type that can be retrieved later in life. I guess it's a question whether memories of that type are formed at all. So I don't have any memories like that from infancy. Most people report the same. And I cannot honestly from my memory tell you a story about anything that happened before I was probably like 4 or 5 or so. You do bring up the idea that there are a small number of people who claim they can remember like being born or being a baby. But even in those cases, while you can't, you know, say, well, you're just wrong, you don't remember that, I think it's reasonable to be skeptical about whether those are real memories or just later confabulations.
Yeah, yeah. And I, on this note, I think it's important to remind listeners that fabricated memories are by no means necessarily intentional. There are numerous ways that, and we've discussed this on the show before, numerous ways that false memories may be encoded. There are plenty of examples of cases where attested early childhood memories can ultimately be attributed to stories one is told about one's younger years,
yeah,
and or something formed out of, say, longing or desire for a certain framework. A lot of stuff like that out there. And again, we, as we've touched on many times before, like we alter memories every time we draw them out. Every time we get them out of the storage, we get our fingerprints all over them and we change them. And then ultimately the memories that are most dear to us, the ones that we pull out the most, are the ones that are potentially the most altered.
Right, because the form in which they are stored in memory is ultimately the form in which you rehearse them. You know, it's not a videotape. It's a constant sort of like rewriting over the same document.
Yeah. Yeah. And to your point though, it is kind of ironic that when you have a young child in the house like this, for parents, this is, or even, you know, other people in that infant's life, these are some of the dearest moments, you know, you're mm-hmm. experiencing these moments and you're like, this is, you can feel it embedding. You know, this is something you're never going to forget. And then on the other hand, you have at least a very strong suspicion that the child is not going to remember it the way that you remember it. It's something that I know that my wife and I talked a lot about with our son when he was much younger. And sometimes my son will comment on this, because when your child gets over, you're always like, well, do you remember this? Do you remember that? Or I remember when this happened, but I know you don't remember it. And so there are a lot of conversations like that. And then sometimes we'll be on a trip and our son at this point, who's almost 11, he'll comment like, oh, well, that baby's not even going to remember that vacation, seeing like a, you know, another couple with an infant on a trip.
Might as well not even take it. Yeah.
Well, you know, that's kind of the joke, right? Like, just go ahead and put your baby in a closet for a few years because they're not going to remember these expensive trips. But of course, you can't do that. That's not how it works. You have to have these moments and these trips. And just because the baby's not recalling it the way an adult recalls something later doesn't mean that it's not, quote unquote, remembered.
Right. Those, instead of, say, having autobiographical memories that can later be retrieved in narrative form, instead, the effect of those experiences might be, say, structural impacts on the development of the brain.
Right. There's a great quote that came up in a paper I'm going to source here in a bit, where they said something that, you know, is quite simple, but I think is important to keep in mind in this context and in memory context in general. The brain remembers what it needs to remember, you know, and the memory demands on, say, a 5-month-old baby or a 1-year-old child, 1.5-year-old child are different. And therefore, again, there's nothing bad about not having, not being able to recall when you were 2 or 3 or 4 or 5. It's just what your brain needed to do. And as we'll get into, there are different reasons for this.
Yeah, so that's what we're going to be exploring in this series. Questions like, why don't most people have specific autobiographical memories of being a baby? Do we have episodic memories of infancy, which get like erased from the brain for some reason? Or do we never form episodic memories of baby life in the first place? Obviously, there's some kind of memory going on in very young childhood and infancy, but maybe it just like it doesn't have an episodic memory component. Maybe it can remember associations and images, but maybe not sequences of events. Or maybe is there some weird third option, like we do form memories and they're not exactly erased later, but they're sort of fuzzy or hard to retrieve for some reason. That's what got me really interested in this this exploration today. But of course, I also got very interested in the question of, before people could do experiments on this, they must have observed childhood development firsthand and had all kinds of questions of this sort and probably come up with answers, whether or not those answers were accurate.
So, let's get a little bit into just sort of some of the history of this, some sort of pre-modern infant opinions and also a little bit of cultural variation. I think one of the things to keep in mind about pre-modern and pre-scientific beliefs about infant memory is that a lot of it is going to come down to older beliefs about what human infants are and what they are not.
Mm.
And so this is all a mixture of things based on cultural tradition, but also based on observation. I think it goes without saying that no matter what may have been ultimately recorded in literature, ancient people, they would have applied different insights and different ideas to the experience of babies, but some things were obviously going to be the same. Babies evoke strong emotions in us. That's just part of the way we're hardwired. Babies require a great deal of care. Babies cry. Babies inherently can't communicate precisely. And also human memories of early childhood or the lack thereof would have been identical more or less to what we have now, or at least any differences are not going to be based merely on, say, the timeline, and we'll get into some of that in a bit.
Right. For example, I would really not say that the current characteristics of infantile amnesia or memory formation in very young children are, say, a result of the internet or some other kind of like technological context, especially because we know people have been in the more modern era doing research on this going back more than 100 years. So before a lot of the sort of like communications and technology context we live in today, people were asking, hey, when are people's first memories and what do they remember about childhood? And the answers were largely the same as what we get when we ask that today.
Yeah. So it doesn't seem like there's any expectation that there's been significant variation in this, aside from variation that occurs for cultural reasons and so forth. But again, a lot of this is going to come down to how we think about babies. And it's interesting because on one hand, yes, we have this inherent draw towards our own young and to the young of our community. And but at the same time, you often hear people talk about older kids and you'll hear them say, well, you remember what it was like when you were that age. You know, there's a certain relatability in that. But generally, they're not saying this about infants or very young toddlers, because by and large, we don't remember what it was like to be that age. We only remember the stories of what we were like at that age and so forth. Now, examining how people in ancient times, for example, thought about babies, thinking about pre-modern and pre-scientific thinking into all of this, you also have to take into account infant mortality rates, which were often high in ancient times. And I realize that infant mortality is not exactly a fun topic, but some of the attitudes of the ancient world surrounding the nature of infants is more sharply expressed over the subject, or so it seems. So we are going to touch on it a little bit, at least in passing.
Yeah, it's sort of unavoidable for most of human history, for most people, just a major fact of life.
Yeah. So I looked at a few different sources about the understanding of infants in ancient Greek and ancient Rome. In Childbirth and Infancy in Greek and Roman Antiquity from 2011, author Varunek Dasan points out a number of interesting things about how these ancient peoples seem to have considered young children based on the evidence we have to go on today. And so I want to outline some interesting points that they bring up. First of all, most of what we know relates to elite children rather than the lives of those born into lower classes or to enslaved people. Also, we have to think about the terminology here. This is fascinating. So, you know, basically the infant toddler dynamic and duality. It's interesting and potentially telling in that changes in terminology may indicate changes in cultural understanding of young children. So, you know, certainly there's a difference between an infant and a toddler, and we tend to sort of, we tend to mark that transition point. But to what extent is that transition point borne out in a people's language? And at what point does the language potentially shift, et cetera? Basically, just sort of a larger background topic to keep in mind. But the big point here is that it's most helpful to think of childhood as a journey, one that hits different milestones, goes through different stages, and this in turn alters the way that adults view the child and the degree to which they can be integrated into society. Also, Dawson points out, quote, in times of high infant mortality, these stages represented steps for hope of survival and increasing parental bonding. And we'll come back to exactly what is meant by that. But basically, it comes down to, like, how does a culture deal with the fact that there is a high infant mortality rate? Is there more of a sort of pushing away, kind of like ultimately a stoic reaction, sort of distancing of the infant from the society, or making it kind of a marginal state? Or is there indeed still a lot of bonding going on and so forth? Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product, and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Now, with the Greek and Roman viewpoint specifically, what we think of as infancy would have probably ended at age 2 or 3 with, full weaning, increased ability to speak, and at age 3, integration into practiced religion, at least at some degree.
Hmm.
Now, medically speaking, it was previously supposed that there was next to nothing in the literature of ancient Greek and ancient Rome to suggest that physicians were concerned with babies, except in exceptional circumstances. It was thought that babies in general were left to the midwives and the mothers. However, Dawson stresses that this is no longer really a correct viewpoint based on numerous examples of writings that have come up about, say, essential diet and hygiene for babies. So I think that's interesting, representing like a shift in our modern understanding about ancient views on infants.
That they were actually sometimes a more relevant object of what was considered medicine.
Yeah, there's sort of this, and we'll get into it more in just a second here, but there was this understanding of the ancient world based on some significant evidence that basically the ruling male elite were saying, like, babies, not even worth your time, not worth my time anyway. Call me when it is old enough for me to care about it. Or if it's exploding, then yes, a physician may come in and check out the child, that sort of thing. Because without a doubt, there seemed to have been far less of a view of baby superiority in ancient Greek and ancient Rome. Dawson writes the following. This is great. Quote, from Hippocrates to late antiquity, babies and toddlers are defined as a category of beings with a special morphology and physiology. These characteristics are on the whole negative. Newborn babies are generally described as imperfect, weak, and ugly.
Wow, perfect. Yes. This reminds me of the story you've shared many times of your son calling the cat a stupid baby, or just a baby, maybe, when it was being
just
mean.
Baby. Like, baby is an adjective, baby mochi, and just a solid burn as a toddler.
It's like peak insult, imperfect, weak, and ugly.
I mean, toddlers get it. And so did the grown learned men of ancient Greece. So Dawson points a few specific authors to underline these views. So Aristotle wrote that babies, quote, are born in a more imperfect condition than any other perfected animal, and also that they have poor eyesight.
Oh, well, it depends on what Aristotle means by that. I'm not sure of the full context, but if he's making a distinction between human beings and other animals, I think that's a fair observation that human babies are more helpless than the newborns of most other animal species.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what he's going for here. There's another work on colors that is sometimes attributed to Aristotle. And in this, it's pointed out that babies are ugly I'm not sure it says ugly, but it points out that they're ugly because they have red faces and little hair.
You ever get the feeling that, like, Aristotle might have been writing about human babies the same way he was writing about, like, stingrays? It's just like, this is something he's observed a couple of times and made a few notes about.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some pretty hairy little babies before, so, I mean, I think it varies.
Yeah.
But yes, on the whole, they tend not to, I guess, have a full head of hair or certainly a proper beard. Now, Galen was one of numerous physicians to comment on the seeming wax-like malleability and weakness of the baby.
Weakness of the baby? Babies are so weak.
They're weak, and they're basically made out of wax. Like, if you don't handle them too much, or you will change their form completely. They do tend to be doughy.
Yeah, that's true. But also, Galen, I can just tell this guy did not spend much time holding a baby because, like, especially Galen probably had a beard. I've got a beard. When you feel the baby grab the beard and just not let go, this is the handle for the adult, and it will pull until it has a fistful of beard hair. You do not walk away with the impression of how weak babies are.
Aristotle also recorded that many babies die within the first week and are therefore not named before this period passes. And this is a kind of approach to the first week or so of a child's life that you see reflected in various cultures and various times. Meanwhile, Plutarch just wonders if babies are in fact animals because they're more like vegetables. They're more like a plant.
I mean, yeah, but plants cry at midnight. Plants poop where they want to. That's exactly what a plant is.
Dasan adds this line here, quote, "A mineral metaphor substitutes for the vegetal one in Kronos' myth, who ate his children as soon as they were born and thought a stone to be a swaddled nursling." So, you know, is it a baby? Is it a stone? Like, anyone can tell the difference, I guess.
Yeah. Is that supposed to be a comment on how featureless and uninteresting babies are? Or is that myth supposed to be a joke about Kronos being stupid?
As a modern English-speaking human, I'm not the intended audience, I guess, for the myth. But I always interpreted it as being like, he's just so consumed with this need to destroy his young, you know, that he's just like, just gobbles them up without really tasting them, you know?
Yeah,
really, he's more like
he's more machine now than man, almost like he's a baby eating machine. He barely notices or has cognizance of what's going in his mouth.
Yeah. So after expressing some of these, aristocratic male opinions on babies recorded in the literature, I think it's a good time to stress something that another author drives home as well. And this is from the work of Maureen Carroll in Infant Death and Burial in Roman Italy from 2015. She points out that we base a lot of our understanding of this topic on the writings of Stoic male aristocratic literary elite, and also the arguments that the remains in Roman cemeteries seem to bear this out. The, I think, quote-unquote, invisibility of the young child in Roman cemeteries.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this is true about a lot of things in the ancient world. When you have to consult literary texts to get a flavor of ancient life, that's necessarily going to be leaving a lot of stuff out because of the sexism of like who could receive literary education and who was writing texts and stuff at the time. You're going to get a lot of aristocratic male perspective.
Yeah. And certainly when you factor in Stoicism, and then also the fact that maybe some of them did not know how much hair a baby had on average, it's well worth taking into account. But on the other hand, you do have this argument that lines up with things, with the writings of, say, Plutarch, who said that infants, quote, have no part in earth or earthly things, and therefore they don't require any of the rites normally performed for the dead. There's just kind of this push and pull over, like, what is the status of the infant? And we can understand, like, this like Stoic approach that's like, look, there's a chance that things aren't going to go well, and then therefore one should be prepared for that by not fully integrating them into life, essentially. But Carroll points out that these views do not necessarily represent those of course other classes, or certainly mothers during the time period. So the seeming invisibility of young children in Italian cemeteries of the time period is something that requires like further examination and perhaps a little more understanding, as opposed to just like, well, they weren't considered real things. Also of note, I was looking at a paper from 2012, Child Exposure in the Roman Empire, by W.V. Harris, published in the Journal of Roman Studies, pointing out that child exposure, like the leaving of a child, you know, in the wild, out in the open, away from humans, that this was widely practiced in the Roman Empire, often when, quote, physical viability and legitimacy were in doubt, but that not everyone agreed with the practice. Stoics, in particular, tended to believe that infants should live at the very least if they're healthy and legitimate. And certainly, there's plenty of room for hypocrisy in something like that. But I also wonder to what extent it backs up or counters the idea that babies in general were considered only halfway real. Here's another great chunk going back to, from Dasan, going back to her paper. Quote, "For Aristotle, infants were defined as a lower category of beings, physically weak, mentally and morally inept, with uncontrolled appetites. Physical disproportions associate them with animals. A heavy upper part explains why children move like quadrupeds. Says Aristotle, quote, that is why infants cannot walk but crawl about, and at the very beginning cannot even crawl but remain where they are."
But remain where they are.
This paper from Dasan doesn't really get into memory all that much. A lot of it's, again, we're dealing more with sort of the overarching views of young children and infants. But Dasan does touch on memory as well in this part. Quote, "Disproportions also explain mental incapacities. the heaviness of a large head impairs the impulses of thoughts, and the infant's memory is bad. Children are further associated with inferior categories of human beings, such as old people, physically weaker, with a poorer memory and less hair, with the insane and the drunk, with a similar irritable temperament and a disorderly behavior, with women, irrational, changeable, and weak, and even with dwarfs.
So you ask, what did ancient Greek philosophers think about babies? And the answer is just a conglomeration of offensive opinions.
Well, yeah, a lot of that is what seems to remain in the literature. But Dasein also stresses that while a lot of this may just sound like, you know, babies are gross and the worst, there's also plenty of evidence that the seeming deficiencies of babies were also very much enjoyed. That it wasn't just like, oh man, this baby's like an old man. It's more like, oh, this baby's like an old man. And the bonding still occurred even in times of high mortality. Their smiles and their skin were written about as being irresistible. And also, I thought this was neat, quote, myths of baby heroes transcend children's deaths. And this is something perhaps worth thinking about. I don't know, we might get into this in the second episode. We might come back at a later time. But you do have a lot of baby heroes and child gods and godlings in various myth and folkloric traditions, from the likes of baby Krishna to the Christ child. But anyway, sticking on the topic of memories or the lack thereof in small children and infants, it would seem that, of course, the lack of memories from one's own infancy was very much a known factor, and that it would make sense within a viewpoint that babies are unfinished and imperfect. They have yet to cross through all the stages of becoming truly human, becoming, you know, truly a part of a family unit, truly a part of society, even if they still amuse us and we still have a lot of emotions about them.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed.
And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. Now, we mentioned earlier cultural differences that could impact just how early one remembers one's life, what one's earliest memories happen to be. And I was looking at an article titled The Culture of Memory by Leah Winterman, published by the American Psychological Society back in 2005. The author here points to research that shows that, quote, the average age of first memories varies up to 2 years between different cultures. And it seems to come down to the weight and importance of memory within a specific cultural system. According to Michelle Leichtman, PhD, cited in the article, quote, people who grow up in societies that focus on individual personal history, like the United States, or ones that focus on personal family history, like the Maori, will have different and often earlier childhood memories than people who grow up in cultures that, like many Asian cultures, value interdependence rather than personal autonomy. So a key 1994 study from psychologist Mary Mullen, published in the journal Cognition, asked more than 700 Caucasian and Asian or Asian American undergrads to describe their earliest memory. On average, Asian and Asian American student memories happened 6 months later. A subsequent study, and we should note there were many subsequent studies that examined different slices of all this, from Mullen, though, found a 16-month gap between Caucasian Americans and Native Koreans. These studies led to a host of others, and it seems to follow the basic social interaction model. Quote, according to this model, our autobiographical memories don't develop in a vacuum. Instead, as children, we encode our memories of events as we talk over those events with the adults in our life. The more those adults encourage us to spin an elaborate narrative tale, the more likely we are to remember details about the event later.
This absolutely dovetails with much of what I've been reading, that like sort of an interactive rehearsal of memories helps make those memories stronger. But sort of the paradox of memory, and this is true not just of childhood, I think this is true of adult memory as well, mm-hmm. is that while that produces a stronger memory consolidation and you are better able to retrieve that memory later, it also makes the memory more subject to contamination by whatever input you're getting from the person you're rehearsing it with.
Or even from outside sources such as advertising. I don't know if this is still the case, but many years ago, I went to the Coca-Cola Museum here in Atlanta with my mother. And there was some bit of advertising. I'm not sure if it was current advertising or past advertising, but the gist of it was Coca-Cola. We've always been there. Like we were a part of your, essentially saying we were a part of all those memories that you hold dear. And I often think of that when I encounter branding from this company, because it's good. It's really infectious. Yeah. It does a great job, but it is kind of like trying to worm its way in there. Like, do you remember that great memory from your childhood? I bet there was a Coca-Cola on the table. And even if there wasn't, bam, there is now.
Well, you could say it's genius, maybe even insidious, the way that they insinuate their branding into inherently nostalgic imagery. So like the Santa Claus with the Coca-Cola.
Yeah,
I think that's not an accident. That's like to try to integrate the brand with your earliest and best feelings from childhood. Oh, boy, Christmas is coming. Here's Santa. And what's Santa got in his hand? A Coke, of course. That's just part of the Santa lore.
Yeah, yeah. So, you could really get into advertising and so forth and all of this as well. But yeah. So even within a given culture, and they're going to have the sort of different cultural leanings based on what sort of emphasis you place on individual experience. But also, there are going to be differences even within a culture based on high elaborative and low elaborative mothers. And I take this to mean. You could basically mean any person in an individual's life, but they're using mother as the main example. So basically the question is a child routinely asked for detailed stories about their daily life, or are they asked mostly closed questions? And this is interesting to think about. Like, yeah, is the child asked to like fully explain their day, or is it just like, did you eat lunch today? Yes. Did you eat your snack? Yes. That sort of thing. And not to say either approach is better than the other. Life is busy, and sometimes you just got to make sure that your child ate a snack and you don't need the full story. But it is interesting to think about, like, perhaps the necessity for that balance, you know, to get a full account of what the day was like, as opposed to just like, did you do the things that were required?
Well, this also connects to some things I was reading about how very young children can, in fact, answer questions about things that happened to them recently, or at least they typically can. This has been studied. But one thing I was reading was that how well, say, I don't know, a 2.5-year-old can describe a memory of a recent event depends very much on how you elicit the memory from them. And you might have seen parents doing this. I'm not at that stage yet in parenting, but I've seen other parents doing this kind of thing. It's like, what did we do on your birthday? You know, did we go somewhere? Where did we go? And mm-hmm. So you can kind of like talk the child through the memory in a way that it seems like the child may not be able to produce the details and connect them spontaneously. Did that make sense, or was that?
Yeah, no. It makes me think of other memory exercises where, like, if one is having, like, the tip of the tongue scenario, where if you're having difficulty remembering a particular name or whatever, like, it's better for your memory for you to keep trying to guess, or for the person on the other end of the conversation to encourage you to guess and not to just give it to you, that sort of thing, making the brain work for those details.
That's true. That was a finding of that episode we did, wasn't it? That like you're more likely to remember the detail you're searching for next time if somebody like gives you a hint and you make the connection yourself versus if you just look up the answer.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, in all this, I think it is important to mention something that Michelle Lichtman points out here, and that is, again, that there's not a wrong direction in any of this. The brain remembers what it needs to remember. We remember what we need to remember. Social pressure contributes to this, but it is what it is.
Now, one question I thought we should look at before we wrap things up today is like, okay, we keep talking in, more general terms about like, well, there's an earlier period where most people can't really produce any memories from that period of their lives, and then a later period where they can. But what are the actual numbers? Like, when does that kick in? This is something that has been studied extensively. There are certainly different methods, and I think we might be able to add some nuance to this answer later on. But it seems to me like the sort of magic age is like 3 to 4 years, or about 3.5 years is what most studies have converged on. And to be clear, also, when we talk about childhood amnesia in the scientific literature, it seems often to refer to two different things that are related. One is the loss of all memories, as far as we can tell, from before the earliest memory we can produce. And then the second thing is the relative scarcity of memories from the early years of childhood compared to equivalent spans of time from later in life. So, for example, even though you have some autobiographical memories from ages 6 to 7, if you are like most people, you will have a fewer number of spontaneous memories that you can recall from that period than from, say, 16 to 17. And I thought it was also interesting to just look at the different experimental methods for trying to find out what people's earliest memories are. There are a number of ways to approach this. Sometimes it's done by, say, just asking people to describe their earliest memory and estimate at what age it took place. That is, of course, a perfectly good place to start. But putting aside for a moment the question of like the accuracy of these memories, you could imagine reasons why just asking somebody what is your earliest memory might not actually produce their earliest memory. For one thing, most people don't keep their memories indexed in a sortable form. You know, it's not an Excel sheet that has a sort by column for date.
And so you may have a memory that occurs to you in one moment as the earliest you can remember, but how do you know in another circumstance you wouldn't think of an earlier one that just didn't occur to you at that time?
Yeah, plus I guess it's worth considering that in many, but certainly not all cases, you have sort of a stability to early childhood. Certainly that is desired, that there would be sort of a sameness to a lot of the early memories. You know, it's like, one or both parents are there. Perhaps the immediate physical surroundings are the same. So like, what is going to be present in a memory to distinguish it and set it apart in the timeline? Again, unless you go back later and then you've encoded it and then you identify it maybe falsely and say, oh, well, this is a memory of, say, when we lived at this house or when we lived in this town.
Yeah, and that raises important questions about, like, the characteristics of what counts as a memory.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wonder if there's a sort of boundary being established by the terms of the demand for recall. For example, an autobiographical memory needs to be something you can put into words and explain to somebody else. But do you ever get that feeling that you're experiencing nostalgia, but it's not for a thing in the outside world, maybe not for an image or an event, but something that it isn't really something you can put into words? It's like nostalgia for an internal state or a feeling. That's kind of a strange thing. I sometimes have that sensation. Of course, when I have that feeling, it's totally possible the memory component of the sensation of nostalgia could be illusory. But sometimes I wonder if maybe feelings like that could be based in really old memories that can't be put into words or something.
Yeah, I'm having trouble remembering a specific example of this, but I think some of my early memories definitely have this component to them. Even if I do remember like a basic setting or event around them, there is at least as strong the feeling of what it meant. Like, there's one particular early memory I have of like running around in circles in a living room around like a dinner, like a dining room table in a living room or a dining room that just seemed enormous, you know, like a cathedral. And so part of it is like these vague memories of what this space looked like, but it's also equally met by the exhilaration that is remembered of just kind of like this, you know, this running around. And it is hard to really explain like what that means, because if I were to run around in circles right now, it would certainly not be the same feeling, you know. It doesn't relate to other memories of physical exertion from other points in my life.
Oh, but then to come back to other methods to study early memories, another one that seems to be used fairly often is the word cue test. So this one's pretty interesting. I say a word to you, and then I ask you to tell me a memory associated with this word, just any memory. We could try it right now, Rob. Do you want to do it?
Sure, let's do it.
Okay, tell me a memory associated with the word jar.
Oh, well, that's easy. I have an early memory of trying to get a jar of maraschino cherries out of the refrigerator by myself, and I dropped it and broke it or spilled it. I'm not sure if I broke it or spilled it, but that is a strong early memory of mine.
Okay, and then from here in the experiment, I might ask you for some subsequent details, like, you know, who was there? Did anybody else witness this memory, et cetera, et cetera? And then I would also ask you, estimate what age you were when this memory happened. But what age do you think it was?
I would say maybe three, but that's a huge guess. And I think I've actually asked my mother about this memory before. And, you know, this is the kind of thing where like kids have things like this happen all the time. They don't necessarily, not necessarily something a parent is going to specifically remember. It makes more of an impact on the child than the parent. Mm-hmm. So I have no idea exactly when this occurred.
Okay, but this is a good answer. Jar of cherries on the floor, maybe spilled, maybe broken. You think you were around three. So I keep doing this. I do this for a big list of words, maybe with a big sample of people. And then you can sort of cross-reference all of the answers you get to look at what ages the memories tend to come from. And you could see by this method that I'm just making up random numbers here, but say by randomly associating memories with words, we end up with people telling us about 20% more memories from ages 16 to 20 than from ages 6 to 10 or something. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a pretty clever method.
But anyway, what this research tends to converge on is that a really important time is roughly the age 3 to 4, or like 3.5. Generally, the earliest memories that adults can produce are around the ages of 3 to 4, and there is not much or nothing from before that. And then after that, there is a gradual increase in the quantity of autobiographical memories from each year of age up until maybe like 7 or 8, when the autobiographical memory store starts to look more like that of the rest of adulthood. So for most people, looking backwards, memories tend to start around 3 or 4, and then you get more of them at 5, more of them at 6, more of them at 7, more of them at 8, and then you start to reach a more kind of complete adult memory set. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that children before the age of 3 or 4 produce no autobiographical memories. Instead, it seems like there may be a sort of period of forgetting. And I thought this was very interesting. Just one study I wanted to mention quickly that gets at this. It was published in the journal Memory in 2005 by Dana Van Abema and Patricia Bauer. And it's called Autobiographical Memory in Middle Childhood, Recollections of the Recent and Distant Past. Now, I was looking for the full text of the study, and I couldn't find it before we recorded today, but I did find a summary of the findings in a Psychology Today article by an author named Vitelli. And basically what happened in the study is that children were interviewed about autobiographical events along with their mothers at the age of 3, and they produced details about those events. So something they did, you know, a trip out to do something, and they could recall things about their own past. So they had some form of episodic memory. They could be prompted to retrieve details about these episodic memories. But those same children were brought back years later at ages 7, 8, and 9, exactly the range at which there seems to be a profound forgetting of early childhood memories. So from Vitelli's summary here, the 7-year-olds could recall 60% of the same autobiographical events they recalled at 3, but the 8- and 9-year-olds could only recall 36 and 38% of events. So there seems to be a major drop-off of memories from this earliest period around the ages of 7, 8, and 9.
Yeah, I think this kind of matches up with some stuff I've observed with my own son, mostly when in talking about things that we watched together when he was in like one age group versus another. And it varies, I think, from picture to picture. Like there's some movies that maybe we've talked about more, that have become more like of sort of a regular part of one's life. And then there are other movies where you like watch it, forget it, and then maybe truly forget it and then come back and experience it again.
Now, why patterns like this emerge is something I think we'll have to get into more when we come back in subsequent parts of the series. I'm not sure how many we're going to go to. We'll have at least one more part, maybe a couple more.
Yeah, there's certainly going to be plenty to get into for a part 2, possibly a part 3. But as we often have pointed out, we're hesitant to say this will definitely go to a certain number of episodes because we're often just a little unsure where we're going to cut it off. Well, how about you, Joe, as we close out this episode? What comes to mind as your earliest jar-related memory? Jars only, please. And even if it's from the last 5 years, that's cool, too.
Well, to bore you with dreadful cliche, I think catching fireflies in a jar, that is very early. We did that a lot when I was a kid in our front yard. We had lots of them. I think I also have very early memories of pickle jars because I recall from early childhood being really into pickles, like pickled cucumbers, like a Clausen's pickle jar.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, clearly I had more of, I guess, the sweet tooth as a child. Yeah. But my son has always been super into pickles of all different varieties, from the little Cornichons to the big dill pickles to the big bread and butter pickles to the slices, all of it.
Though with both of those, I guess those are just sort of like ambiguous, continuous states of childhood. Catching fireflies in jars, it's just something that happened often. I don't remember a particular instance of it. Same with admiring the pickle jar and wanting its contents. if I had to produce a more I don't know, a direct autobiographical specific memory. It'd probably be a more recent one. I don't remember if you, I think you asked me for my earliest, but if I were just doing the word cue test, I'd probably say, oh, from when I was 35 and I made kimchi in a large jar on my table. And I remember how it smelled and all that.
Oh, nice. Well, you know, I think it's worth telling everyone, like, go out now and create some positive jar-based memories with your children. Even if they're grown now, it's never too late to create a jar-based memory. All right, well, on that note, we're going to go and close out this episode, but we'll be back with more on this topic. And in the meantime, certainly write in with your thoughts on all of this. And yeah, if you want to share some of your earliest memories with us and sort of attempt to define when these memories occurred, and if you have any, if you've been able to dig around and ask other people to sort of prove them out, to see if they are in fact largely authentic or if they've been augmented in any way. We'd love to hear from everyone throughout these episodes.
But this is going to produce a skewed sample because we're going to hear from everybody who's like, I can remember being one, but people aren't going to write in to tell us I don't remember being one.
No, right. You can write in with that. If you're like, my earliest memory is being, five or older, whatever, like write in. Like we said, there is no wrong answer here. The people who claim to remember being born, it doesn't mean their brain is better. Their memory is better than another individual. Again, we're going to continue to discuss this as we explore this topic. No wrong answers. All right. So we close it out. We'll just remind you that core episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind publish on Tuesdays and Thursdays in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. On Mondays, we do listener mail. On Wednesdays, we do a short form Monster Fact or Artifact episode. And on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film. And this week, I think it's going to be a pretty fun one that will tie in with early childhood memories for many people, because I think we do form a lot of early childhood memories based on movies we're exposed to. Mm-hmm. So perhaps we'll get into that a little bit as we discuss this week's title.
Huge thanks to our audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.